This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Teeple. That's me. And we're broadcasting from Icon Gallery. That's the Gallery of Iowa Contemporary Art on the square in Fairfield, Iowa, in the 1 square mile of Iowa Cultural District here in Iowa, United States of America. All right, Donna, you've got something about preservation that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I just thought it would be an interesting thing. It kind of was sparked by an article I read in a paper or magazine or something about wedding dresses and how there's some kind of a scandal going on where people who have taken their wedding dresses to the dry cleaners to have them specially cleaned and sealed in hermetically sealed in some box where the wedding dress is never going to decay, and then they tie it up and seal it and give it back to the person. And a few times people have opened them up and discovered there was no wedding dress in there. There was just like some, or just the veil or something. They were, because people figured they're never going to open the box, or they're not going to open them for like decades, and then, you know, they can go sell the dress or whatever. But I don't really want to talk about that trend, but just the whole idea of taking a valuable object and sealing it away somewhere just to preserve it and have it in your closet. And I was thinking of other things like jewelry that people never wear. It's just like in the vault, in their little safe or a locked jewelry box, or things like baseball cards that former brother-in-law still has all of his baseball cards from the 1950s, very valuable ones, Mickey Mantle and everything, and they're in a shoebox tucked away in someplace, and maybe he pulls them out every 20 years or something and looks at them, but he has them. Artworks also are often sealed somewhere and brought out only once in a while for somebody to look at. So I thought
this is a huge topic that we could go in many different directions with. There's two aspects to the art world. I'll just mention this as a place to go with this. One is the aesthetic experience. And Iowa contemporary art is all about the aesthetic experience. Then there's the other side of the art world, which has to do with investment in a valuable commodity, which are a tangible, it's a kind of investment. Tangible objects are a way of, you can put your money in gold, you can put it into real estate, you can put it into art, and a lot of people invest in art. And those people are very concerned about keeping this in the vault, just like money. That doesn't interest me at all, because what I'm interested in is aesthetic experience, and those objects contain aesthetic experience. If they're just, I mean, a pretty gold piece of gold is actually quite aesthetically beautiful to me, but to most people it's holding wealth. So that's one side of this story. And it's always mixed. In the art world, there's always people looking at the artwork as some kind of a way of making money. And there's people that just go the people I run into usually don't have money to buy artwork and are just totally interested in the aesthetic experience and come in Icon to just groove on the stuff and get what you get off of art. People that buy for investment, some will be the people that will put it away. I have collectors and stuff that have this stuff because they just want to look at it in their home, and they're not so concerned about whether it gets bumped even so much as that they just like to look at this stuff.
Yeah, it seems like you want to have...
So my whole side of the story is the aesthetic side and not the holding wealth side. There's another issue here, and that's that people tend to forget that they won't live forever. And they think that they're going to have everything that they have forever. And so they sort of hoard stuff, and they want it to last as long as possible. And they can't think of the whole... I think the people that think they're going to live forever also are in denial about things changing and decaying and going away. So there's some kind of a stress there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's at play here, too. I don't know. Does Alan have any comments on this subject?
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them in the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies. And it goes on a little bit and it ends with, and on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Round about the base of that colossal wreck, the lone and level sands stretch far away. That's Percy Bysshe Shelley. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously what came to mind. You know, we do forget that things don't last forever, even if we make huge monuments of stone. And the real question is, what difference does it make? You know, what kind of sort of misplaced need or value or priority is behind the need to leave a mark? I mean, we all want to leave some kind of mark. We don't really want to be just completely forgotten as soon as we're gone. And yet, for most of us, that's exactly what will happen. And you know, it's nice to know that you wrote a book or painted a painting and that someone has it hanging on their wall, but, you know, when they leave, their heirs and assigns will probably put it in the garage. You know, and from there, it'll just get junked until maybe someone discovers it and it turns out it's one of the teeples that people have been hunting for over these many generations.
Well, and sometimes they do treasure it, the heirs, you know, they'll, there are people who inherit things that are valuable things, and then they put it in their attic, or they put it in some storage room or something, some storage unit to keep, because this was something of value passed on to my family, but then they don't use it in their generation, and then possibly even the next generation inherits it and goes, oh, this is a really valuable thing that belonged to my great-great-grandmother. I must keep this, but it's in the box in the attic as well. Just being saved, not being enjoyed at all.
You know, it may wind up in the museum.
It may.
It may also. I mean, this is like the luck of the draw or the crapshoot that you know of evolution and life. You know, it may end up in the hands of one of the heirs who just doesn't care and just mm-hmm. tosses it too.
Right,
the rest of them have preserved it so well in a vault for 100 years, and then finally somebody inherits it and says, "What is this?" Tosses.
Or actually, I suppose the other thing could happen that there's some karma to these objects, and somebody down the road, five generations from now, is meant to have that, you know, and will totally appreciate it. And if it hadn't been kept there in the attic all that time, it wouldn't be there for that person to enjoy.
And it could be that it's waiting around for that one person who can really get it and appreciate it.
Well, like, I just actually read Wendell Phillips' book, Katabon and Sheba.
Really?
Remember? When George Ferrier was here at ICON doing it, when we had the Dodge Power Wagon posters and all that. I bought one of his books, but I had never actually read it all this time. And then the last time I was visiting my mom, I discovered something that my mom is 88 years old, and I never knew. She had never told me before that she had always wanted to be an archaeologist. And she had actually been to ancient Greece once when my dad was still alive, and that was thrilling for her. But immediately I thought of this book, that she would probably love to read this book, but I hadn't read it yet. So I thought, I'm going to read it first and then send it to my mom. And it was a riveting book, but it really gave you the sense of excitement at pushing away the sand and discovering these old inscriptions and statues and things like that had been buried there for centuries, and that gave people a glimpse into the world back then, which is, I guess, another topic, is why are we so fascinated with relics of the past? What is it? Because we all do sort of get it. I mean, most of us get some kind of a rush about seeing these objects, whether it's in a museum or antique store or whatever.
Yeah, I think the past, it's sort of like we were talking about memory in a previous show, the way memory becomes layers of re-emphasizing the same memory to the point where you're no longer remembering the original experience, but you're remembering how many times you've remembered it, and they kind of add up and reinforce themselves. And I think in the or meeting a celebrity, you know, the past is like a celebrity. It's charged with meaning. It's full of stories and implications and connections. And I guess in the same way that we, you know, hang on to little memorabilia items, archaeological artifacts represent sort of the ultimate memorabilia. An entire civilization is represented by this, you know, old coin or piece of a broken amphora. I guess the thing that's, you know, we started with is really the misunderstanding or the sort of perversion of memorabilia, where preserving it is more important even than experiencing it.
Mm, yeah, that's the strange part.
Yeah, and that sort of seems to fit into the same category as people who prepare to do something and never actually get around to doing it. They spend all their time, you know, setting up a studio.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get the studio just right, they'll be able to do really wonderful paintings in it. But 10 years go by and the studio gets more and more refined.
Yeah, I had a friend who was like that.
Yeah.
It's very sad, actually.
Yes, it can be tragic. I have a friend who did that in about six different disciplines, one after another, and never got to actually really doing anything in any of them. And clearly the process of setting up and the dream of what you're going to be doing and all the potential becomes the goal instead of the real creation part. And even that is a little bit like looking at a blank canvas and thinking, okay, here it is. Mm-hmm. Anything is possible now. And as soon as you begin to do it, you're limited by what you have done and what you are capable of doing.
Yeah, so maybe the potential, maybe it's that seed of potential that gets you excited, and then once you step into that, you've gone beyond that, and so you don't feel the same.
Well, it's fear.
Yeah, it's fear.
It's fear because I know this very well. I'm an art teacher. And an artist. I know the whole thing really well, a creator. And the dreaming, I mean, the longing and the dreaming and all that is romance. It's like living in the romance of the thing. The actual doing of it is really hard work,
mm-hmm.
and not easy. It's difficult. And it just is, you've got to pull this thing out of nothing and make it and manifest it and completely. That's hard. That's just plain lonely hard work.
Mm-hmm.
If you pull it off, it's the biggest thrill in the world. And it's just between you and the object.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. But it's not easy. But I know so well the dreaming, longing, romantic, projecting and all of this that comes first. My only fulfillment is enjoying that fully and then doing it and then the full complete circle, because I have to make stuff, I have to manifest stuff. The other, it feels like stillborn or impotent and all that to me.
So maybe that's a similar thing to these people who have some treasured object that's stuck in a box in the attic. There's some almost romantic notion about even having it hidden away, that it's got a kind of secret life instead of, you know, you have like some rare teapot or something that's been in your family for 200 years, and to actually use it on your kitchen table as a teapot would maybe take a little bit of the romance out of it. Whereas if it's up in the attic in a box and you look at it every 10 years or something and think about your ancestors, maybe that actually is giving the people more in some way.
It's an irrational, and I don't know this thing.
I don't know either why they do that.
We don't quite know why that goes on.
I think it's a balance of fear and dream. Fear and hope, let's say. And I only just considered that hope and dream are, in a sense, the opposite of fear. Fear is you know, anticipation of negative stuff, and hoping is anticipation of positive stuff. And by putting these things away, or by just grabbing onto them, you don't have to hide them. If you have more fear, maybe you do have to hide them. If you have less fear, maybe you can have them on display. If you have even less fear, maybe you'll use them. But I think that's really, those are the main forces at work. It's another example is, and I've seen this in myself, I've found a really good source of hard to find screws and fasteners. So I bought a few of them, and I beg your pardon, that was that was Cannonball Adderley again. He keeps calling me. But I got a collection of these different types of hardware, and the collection has a certain perfection to it. There's 100 of each of these different size screws, and they are hard to find. So now I'm tempted not to use them so that I'll have them when I really need them, instead of using them when I just need them. And it's the same thing. It's sort of clinging to something because you're afraid you'll lose it, and whether it's a memorabilia
This is starting to awaken a deep fear. No, it's awakening a memory of a deep fear. Uh-huh. That has been my project for the last decade. And I think I may have talked about this before on the radio, that I came here 10 years ago with the intention of experiencing what it was like to actually perform in life, not be preparing. This is what we talked about a minute ago, this thing of like getting ready to, and people can just that whole thing we were just talking about. Now I'm realizing that's been my project now for the last decade, is the ability to live in present time and respond directly. Whether I respond direct, good or bad, it doesn't really matter to me, as long as I'm fully responding now. And this is what it's about. Not that, somebody's going to come up towards me. I better go run away, go in a room somewhere and figure out my response, when it'll be when this person comes up to me. You know, that's sort of thing.
And I was
desperately disliking in my way of functioning in the world, and so I came here to actually confront my fear and like live life in the moment based on what came at me, and have confidence in what was going to come up out of me in response to that stimulus. And that has actually changed my life completely. I suddenly felt like I was in my dharma by doing that. Otherwise, you're never where you are. You're never in present time. You're always thinking about past or future.
So this opens up another whole direction, which is hiding ourselves away in either our studios or our families, or you know, our old behavior patterns or whatever, and not moving forward in whatever. You know, you had your way of how you had to move forward to break out of that, and all of us have our own ways. But the whole desire for security is such a strong thing, whether it's financial security or, you know, emotional security or any other kind. And it's such an illusion. Most of the things that people think are going to give them security, it turns out they really aren't dependable. But it's still such a huge desire. And probably that's the whole thing about the tucking away the wedding dress and the jewelry and all of that, too. It has to do with an illusion of security. I don't want something to happen to this.
Right. It's usually that I don't want something to happen to this.
I think it's also related to burying the dead. It's sort of like a wedding dress,
This whole thing has to do with not being able to deal with change and death.
Because you want to save that wedding dress because it's just too valuable. You can't just toss it. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to just give it to some person you don't know. And you might save it for someone who's just the right size, who's getting married, who has the same taste, and the styles happen to still be in fashion, and so on and so forth. But that's pretty unlikely.
But no, the intellect never goes to those kinds.
It's always just in case.
My daughter will wear it in her wedding or something.
Right.
And the poor daughter has to deal with that thought later.
Pressed upon me.
Well, we have one of these wedding dresses in the cedar chest, in the storage, in Los Angeles, it's very tiny. It's very, very old fashioned. It's my mother's wedding dress, which I think might have been her mother's wedding. I mean, there's a tradition here that we're poking into. It's all faded. It's all this lace. It's a fantastic thing. So it's a kind of a precious object, but it's all faded. I mean, nobody would ever wear it. It's in the, I'm keeping it. That old storage thing ought to just get burnt. So I'm doing the very thing we're talking about, but not in a neurotic way. I mean, I personally would just soon have it all taken away, but I'm not having it all taken away.
So how often
That's
do you look at it?
That's a collector's thing. I look at it about once every decade or 20 years or so. I mean, when my mother died, looked at it when we went through everything. Janet and I actually wonder what to do with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And being in Los Angeles, I pay $50 a month to care for this stuff. Yeah. And I haven't decided where I'm going to move it next.
It is interesting. Well, there are some things that are preserved and used. Like, I once had a pass to the Rare Books Room in the New York Public Library, where they kept handwritten manuscripts from the 1500s and so forth. And you could actually, if you went through the three locked doors and, the woman had them all, they were all sealed in these glass cabinets that preserved them and all that. But you could actually sit at a table. The woman would, with her white gloves, she would bring them to you, and you weren't allowed to use any pens or anything near them. But you could actually handle them and look at these things. And it was a wonderful thing that somebody decided to preserve those manuscripts in that way, but then give access to people who had a reason to.
I like old stuff. I mean, I have an appreciation of history, so we're going to go in here and delve into my psychology. When I look at the wedding dress, or when I look at the old pictures, or all of John Stimson's old coins, I'm at that moment, when I'm looking or touching, I'm there. It connects me with 1925, or it connects me with 1540. And somehow there's a unity thing that happens with the past by seeing the past. There was a time when I was young when I all of a sudden realized that those guys dressed up in those outfits in like 1503 or 1580 or whenever, Elizabethan, 1580. They're just us walking around in those kind of clothes then, but being just regular people like us, and same stuff going on that was going on now was going on then, but they had less technology and better clothes. but they had cognition rather than some distant sort of like historic thing you see in the history books. It was like real for me. And I connected, there was this connection with human intelligence moving through time and change that I find interesting in studying history.
Yeah, and that's, I think that breaks your boundaries. I mean, maybe even just the fact that you only look at your grandmother's old wedding dress every 10 years, it may still have that value for you because it expands you and your connection with your family and time and all of that. So there's a lot of possible
but
things.
But I do, how many minutes are we? We have almost
two and a half.
I'll just bring up this one thing. I have felt like there was almost an epidemic of collecting in the last decade or so that seemed sort of like alarming to me. There was something like a neurotic need for this thing, or this idea that it was going to be worth something someday, you know, Beanie Baby, everything from to baseball cards or anything. I mean, it just seemed...
Star Wars figures.
It just seemed almost weird, like everyone was so busy holding on to what's passing by, either with the idea that it was going to be worth something or it was just, you got to
cool
collect
collection.
That.
Yeah.
That it, I mean, it felt like an epidemic to me. It seemed more so than in the past. Mm. I don't know.
Well, and the people who are producing those things, hoping to inspire people to buy a lot of them for their collections, had a lot to do with that, I think, you know, because the promotion of all these objects, it makes you... I remember when my kids were little and Dane started collecting Star Wars figures, I got as much into it as he did because they were cool little figures, you know, and you wanted to have the whole set because, but then he played with them and I played with them too because they were neat little things. And then at some point, somebody sold them in a yard sale and, you know, and maybe every 5 years or so, Dane or I will go, oh, we don't have those anymore. And it's like a little pang, but it just disappears in a moment. You know, it's not like there's a real great sense of loss.
And maybe that's the thing that drives the people that keep it, because most of us sort of let it go. It goes like my baseball cards. I had the Mickey Mantle too, but
yeah,
it just went. But some people feel if we just hold on to this long enough, it's really going to be valuable.
Right, yeah.
And that's probably drives that whole
preservation
thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's partly the dream of it being an investment and partly the compulsion to have a complete collection and partly, you know, the need, the fear of losing the past. Yeah. That's three pretty good motivators right there.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.